Running a business shouldn't feel like surviving a software group project. One app for accounting, another for inventory, another for sales, and somehow none of them talk to each other. That's where Odoo comes in, an all-in-one business management software that brings every part of your business together, from sales and accounting to inventory and marketing, all in one powerful platform. No messy integrations, no bouncing between tabs, and best of all, no spreadsheets. Stop managing software and start managing your business with one unified system. Try for free today at odoo.com/iHeartRadio. That's odoo.com/iHeartRadio.
Yep, he's planning another project. So this Father's Day at Lowe's, tap into free gifts for dad. Get a free select Craftsman power tool when you buy a Craftsman B20 charger with 2 amp hour and 4 amp hour batteries. Plus, get a free DeWalt power tool when you buy a select 20-volt max XR 4-amp-hour battery kit. Dad knows. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 7/14 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casinos, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Today on The Grave Talks, the haunting of Native American spirits. A conversation with Ronnie Headley. Respect for the dead is a standard in almost every culture. However, as time passes on, it seems to some that respect has an expiration date. Blind progress makes the demands of businesses to move or excavate the dead a priority, rather than letting them rest where they lie. Today, we discuss the spirits who guard such places and the repercussions of disrespecting the dead with Ronnie Headley.
It started when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I actually saw the apparition of my grandmother's sister. It was a crazy story. I got up one morning about 2 a.m. to go get some water in the middle of the night and came in, and she was sitting in a rocking chair that she always sat in when she came to visit. And she was almost like a second grandmother to us. Mm-hmm. And I was very close to her. And so she's sitting in her rocking chair, rocking in our living room, and she crocheted a lot. So she was like twiddling her thumbs because that's the way she always kept her hands busy. And even when she wasn't crocheting, she would move her fingers and everything and talk. And she said, I said, I didn't know you were here. And she said, well, I just came to tell you that everything's okay. And I said, okay, let me get some water and I'll be right back. And I came back through and she was gone. And I thought, well, she's either gone to bed or I was just sleepwalking some, you know, and mm-hmm. got to bed and everything, got up the next morning, and about 8 o'clock, the phone rang and it was her daughter. And she said, mother crossed over at 2 a.m. this morning, but we didn't want to call you and bother you in the middle of the night because there wasn't anything you could do. Wow. So that was always in the back of my head. I consider myself a professional paranormal investigator, and I say that because I've been doing this for 43 years. Mm-hmm. And started here in the Bible Belt when, you know, it just wasn't cool being in the sure. Bible Belt doing this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was before Taps made us all famous. I went to work as a paramedic and a funeral director in the city of Birmingham, Alabama, after I got out of the military and everything, and went to work in a funeral home. And the first night there, I saw an elderly gentleman coming down the steps of the funeral home after we had closed, and I was locking up and going through, and he was coming from the apartment area. Mm-hmm. So I kind of walked all over the building trying to find him and couldn't. And I even went into our selection room. We had like this huge funeral home. We had two chapels on two different streets so we could conduct two funerals at the same time. All these visitation rooms and flower rooms and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm going through all those areas, and I said, well, you know, maybe he's got Alzheimer's and he just went and laid down in a casket thinking it's a bed, you know. So I'm going through opening all the caskets, looking, couldn't find him. Next morning, my boss came in and he said, you look rough. And I told him, he said, come on up to my office. Well, his office is the only room in that building I did not have a key to. And I walk in and he says, have a seat. And he pulls out a picture and he says, is this him? I said, same hat too. He says, that's my grandfather that actually started this business in the 1800s.
Oh, gosh.
And he said, I've seen him. You've seen him. My kids have seen him. Other directors have seen him. He said he would come down about that time of night and come into his office and finish the day's paperwork because he didn't like to leave anything undone. And he said, if you noticed in the afternoons when I go, I put my all the paperwork I haven't finished off my desk in this bottom drawer. And said, the reason being is that if I don't, I come in the next morning, this paperwork's all over my room. And so that having that first experience and that experience is kind of like its own. I got to find out where this is and where it's coming from and why it's around us.
Wow. When you saw the apparition of that man, you just thought, this is a person. It didn't strike you as a ghost or anything like that initially.
No, absolutely not. It struck me as just a person coming down the steps, you know, and he went through a doorway out in from the back office there area there into the main chapels and visiting rooms. And I'm like going behind him. I lost sight of him when I went through the door and I'm calling like, sir, I'm sorry, but we're closed.
Yeah.
And thinking, you know, I'm talking to a human.
Sure.
But then when I went through, every door was still locked from the inside and all the windows and everything were locked. So
let me ask you this. And we're going to kind of take a few steps back because I want to unpack some of the stuff you said about your grandma's sister's ghost. When you had that experience and you found out the next day with that phone call that she had passed away, was it an unexpected passing?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
It was, an unexpected passing.
Then you get this information and you got to be processing. Oh my God. You know, then what was that last night? Cause you're thinking she's just hanging out until you realize that she was already dead. How did you process that at that moment? And did you tell any family or talk about it with anybody?
I didn't really talk about it, but it's in my mind. Like, how did this happen? You know, why? You know, why did I wake up at 2 o'clock and she died at 2 o'clock? So it was just kind of always in the back of my mind. But I never could figure out what had happened and why it happened to later on when I started learning, you know, that there was another side to this world in the afterlife. And that's when it piqued my interest into trying to figure out what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, have you learned from any other family members? Were you the only one that she appeared to?
It appears that I was. I mean, nobody else has talked about it.
Uh-huh.
So if they did, they didn't talk about it.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be fun to bring up at a family gathering?
Oh, yeah, sure.
All these years later. Probably depends on the family a little bit. So let me ask you this as we get to the funeral home experience, because you had that initial one and you kind of like, you had some personal affirmation there that this stuff is real. You know, sometimes it takes some more time, though. You're at the funeral home. Number one, what drove you to decide, let's go work at the funeral home?
Well, I worked in the medical field for many years.
Okay.
About 18 years, you know, working the streets on an ambulance, drove critical care transport for University of Birmingham's hospital and Children's Hospital in Birmingham. And and on the off day of driving critical care, I worked a regular ambulance.
Okay.
And the regular ambulance, we had contracts with funeral homes.
Sure.
And, you know, bringing in bodies in the coroner's office and things like that. So being around the coroner's office, saw the owner of this funeral home son on a regular basis in and out of there. And one afternoon, he just told me, he said, hey, we need another funeral director. And, you know, so you're always here working and everything else. Would you be interested? So I went and sat down and talked to him and, you know, took a part-time job working in the funeral home.
Let me ask you this, because obviously we're in the medical field already before you then got into that job. You're seeing a lot of, you know, traumatic moments for people left and right in that sort of field and people dying as well. Had you had any other paranormal experiences in that window from the childhood experience to when you started working at a funeral home?
I am Native American Cherokee descent, but it's way back there. At the time, I was about in the late 80s, early 90s. I joined one of the oldest and largest state recognized Cherokee tribes in Alabama, and eventually got elected into a clan chief position. You have a principal chief, which is like the president, a vice chief, like vice president, and then you have your council, which is like Congress.
Okay.
Council is called clan chiefs. So I was over seven of the largest counties in Alabama. And so doing that, I worked with the state archaeologist and things like that. I tell people ask me a lot of times, are you psychic? Are you a medium or anything? I kind of tell people I'm intuitive. If I'm around something, I kind of can feel it. It's like a gut feeling, something you can feel in your gut.
Sure.
And it just points you in a direction. So I had a lot of experience in that of going out with the archaeologist and saying, you know, we'd say, hey, this was a village over here and everything else. And something would be pulling me somewhere else. And I'd say, hey, let's look over here for a minute, you know, and we'd find graves or something in those areas. So I have had a little of what I call being intuitive to that degree, going different areas and walking around and just being pulled to something.
Sure. And tell me about that. I mean, the first time you realized that was something that you had, that was it kind of a slow build and like, well, this is kind of weird. And then you realize it happens more and more. How did you come to that realization?
I came to the realization when I was fighting the largest county in Alabama over a Native American mound and burial site. They were trying to dig through this area and tunnel through because they were under a federal court order about improving their sewage and sewer systems. And they were running behind on it, and they were being fined and all this kind of thing. So somebody from within called me and said, hey, they're going through this burial site. They're planning on going through this burial site. So I went down to look at it, and I had to trespass in on their property, and I did. And I got in on the backside and everything, and I'm walking around, and it was on an area of a creek that fed into the Warrior River, and which is a navigable waterway. And I got into that creek and everything, and I'm sitting there, and I just kind of, you know, said a little prayer, you know, like, you know why I'm here, Creator, you know why I'm here. I'm trying to do good with this. I'm trying to prevent this, but you're going to have to help me and point me in the direction. And so I just started taking some pictures at different angles and everything. Well, what made this thing unique was it was a mound site, but it had all three types of mounds that are different mound sites. It had a domiciliary, it had a ceremonial, and it had a burial mound all right there together, which is usually not the way it works. And one of the most amazing things about it, when the archaeologists actually took part of the mound down, they found the remains of a woman, a child, and a dog. In the burial mound, I mean, in the ceremonial mound. And so that was quite unusual. And so when I went back home, the Mavica digital camera had just come out where you put it on the floppy disk, if you remember those.
Yeah.
And that's what I was using. So I loaded it into my computer and turned my computer on, you know, on my photo screen and everything. And when I pulled it up, there in the middle of one of the pictures of where I was trying, where I'd said my prayer, was an apparition of a woman, a dog, and a child.
Oh, wow.
In that photo. And then when I finally got the state archaeologist and got him involved and in there with me, the exact place that was on that photo is the exact place that mound stood. So
That's got to be quite a moment. I'm curious, is that a picture that you showed to others as making your case?
Yes, it was.
What did others see it as clearly as you did?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Good.
I mean, it was crazy. But I mean, we, you know, and just being around things, getting pulled to things, mm-hmm. same thing with investigations. I have a team that we formed. We are Tennessee Paranormal. We are Tennessee Paranormal Ghost Tours too, because we have some locations that we offer to teams, and we actually wanted more people that had seen it on TV or had had different, you know, watching it and everything and wanting to get involved and learn. Mm-hmm. We actually take public in on these two small groups and sure. teach them and set up the equipment and help them, mm-hmm. you know, have their investigation. Like I tell people, you know, I can sit here and show you pictures and let you hear EVPs and yeah. tell you stories all day long, but that's my experience. Until you get sure. out and do it, that's when it becomes yours.
Let me ask you, I want to talk about the burial ground sites and kind of talk about that for a little bit to understand that even more. When you found out that they were planning on doing the sewer project, number one, forgive me if I'm asking dumb questions here, but I'm just trying to understand. Are there restrictions against digging into an Indian burial site if it's off a reservation? Does it have to be proved if there's a burial site? Is it evident if there's a burial site? I'm just like, because it seems quite insane if they can just dig through it without, you know, with a wild abandon. What are the rules with something like that?
There's actually a federal law that's, you know, the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act.
Yeah, sure.
And that stops them from doing that. I mean, there's, you know, they have to notify tribes and yeah. everything else. But we had a crooked commission in at the time, and they were just trying to get ahead of the game and trying to do and
yeah.
yeah. Their outlook on it was, oh, it's better to ask for forgiveness than for permission type
thing.
Oh,
God,
you know?
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So are all of these sites, are they known? Are they marked? Are they just kind of out there in, you know, on people's private land, but it's known? And how are they marked? Or are there a lot that are just suspected that this might be, but you have to find proof?
There are several that are marked. Mm-hmm. Back during the South, during the Depression, they mm-hmm. had the concentration camps, where the CC camps is what they called them, where they would hire people and they'd go out and they'd do these projects like building the walls and roads and stuff at national parks, uh-huh. and, you know, working with state agencies and stuff. So a lot of them went through and found things, in the case of some of it, they actually excavated with state archaeologists and university archaeologists to try to explore some during that time.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of it's marked. A lot of it, the native tribes and everything, you know, we have records of where all this stuff was. And
okay.
we don't tell people, because you don't want people going out there in the middle of the night digging up grave sites, trying to take pottery and jewelry and,
okay.
you know,
okay.
and things like that. So we kind of have people that just kind of keep eyes on these things.
Okay. I was curious how that worked. So let me ask you this. Obviously, nobody, I mean, most sane people would never want, you know, that to be disturbed by somebody going through and, you know, excavating for some sort of project. Let me ask you this, though. When the archaeologist was out there and he had to dig into it, and he found the remains of that family that you also had shown up in your picture, if it's already known that this is a burial site, why is anyone digging into it?
Exactly. And what they did when the concentration, the CC camp and everything that came through at that time, they had excavated down to the mounds, down to a level, but they had found the remains of four different sites that had been there previously underneath, from the post holes and things like that, from the walls and things.
Uh-huh.
The fire pits, they'd found these other sites, but they did not go below that. So there was no telling what was below those sites that
yeah.
they were going to dig into and destroy. And so that was the reason of going in and putting up this fight.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The archaeologist coming in, it was almost like, we really have to prove it to you. We will find you some bodies. And is that just kind of what had to be done to show that this is legit?
Oh, no, he had all of the state records and everything from where they had excavated it during the Depression area.
Oh, okay.
And that's when the bodies were removed.
Okay.
University of Alabama has a place called Moundville Archaeological Park.
Mm-hmm.
Every time a Native American is unearthed or moved or something like that through the state, it's in a depository there. They have over 10,000 Native American bones and boxes on shelves there.
That seems like it would be a very haunted place.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, and I guess I why are they all on boxes and shelves? Why are they not like in a proper resting place where they...
I have gone in and fought that battle with them for many times. The gentleman that is the curator for the University of Alabama there tells me that, well, he shows me these graphs and says, in 1940, this is what we knew. And then he shows you a graph with a big increase, and this was 50, and this was 70, and this is 90, and this is 2000. What will it be in 2050? And I'm like, well, can't you just take DNA with what we've got now and do studies with DNA?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, that's not what we do. And he said, well, if it'll make you feel better, we have three Europeans in boxes back here, too. So my reply was, so you're telling me it takes three Europeans to be equal to 10,000 Native Americans.
What the heck? It's just insane. I mean, it's almost like we put an expiration on the sacredness of someone being buried.
Exactly.
It's like, well, after, you know, this maybe like the couple generations that would have any idea who this person was, but they know they existed. But once we're just the fact of we know you existed, then we can put you in a box and dig you up. That just seems utterly ludicrous. I mean, it's one thing if, you know, you're digging in your backyard and, oh, you happen to come across somebody was buried here at one time, you know. That can be a little unsettling, but it's unintentional. It's one thing if you're going through and like, we know there's bodies here, but we want to put in the brand new Walmart. You know, it's like
exactly, exactly. But working with the state archaeologists, that's what we did. We tried to prevent that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and we'd notify tribes, like if it was Cherokee or Choctaw or Creek or whoever was in the area, we'd notify them. Then we'd come in and make a solution, you know, whether, yes, we'll remove them and repatriate them somewhere else, with ceremonies and things like that. Or, like one of them was going to be in a parking lot.
Yeah.
And they had planned on putting these concrete things, you know, barriers in with light posts and all of that. It's like, okay, so why don't you just pour a pad of concrete here and put, you know, a wrought iron around it so nobody can get into it, and they're protected forever. Nobody's going to take time to dig through the concrete and all of this.
Yeah.
So that was one way of protecting it. Or, you know, you're going to have to reroute a road or something.
Sure.
But then you get into when they hit these things, they'll try to, it stops the project immediately. They have to call the archaeologists. They fall months, if not years, behind on their project. So a lot of times they just try to ignore it and just cover it up and go on.
Yeah. I mean, if you're the contracting company, and I mean, how often does that happen, do you think, where they're going and they start finding this stuff, but it's just like, nope, no, we didn't. And they just kind of keep going and it doesn't go much further than that.
Oh, it happens all the time. I mean, it's a constant battle of trying to keep eyes on these places that we know. And there's places we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, but the ones that we do, just trying to keep eyes on it so that, you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen.
I want to talk about that, but I want to go back to one other thing before we get off the topic of it. The location, is it the university you said that has the 10,000 bodies or, you know, remains in it?
It's a state depository, but it's called Moundville Archaeological Park. There are, I think there's 30 something mounds down there. Some of them are open to the public and some of them aren't. They're scattered through the wood line. That's another one that they went and dug up and everything.
Yeah.
And then back then, before we had the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, it was on the Warrior River, which is a navigable waterway through Alabama. And they would come up in steamships and everything from these other universities and, you know, Europe and England, and they would just dig. And they've got piles there of broken pottery and stuff that they broke or was broken when they went through. They just tossed it off and made like a garbage pit out off one of the embankments down there. That, you know, of course, with erosion and everything else, it's been covered over today. But still, it's there. And that's how a lot of these universities and stuff get these Native American collections that they've got in their museums. Mm-hmm. And is by doing that. And that was prior to the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act. When that happened, they also had to quit displaying the bones and things like that. I can remember as a child going to Moundville Archaeological Park, and they used to have when you walked into the gift shop museum, they had a room they'd go in and turn on the lights, and you'd go up to this wall and look over, and it was down to the burial pit where they had excavated, and there were skeletons of warriors and women and children laying there on these earthen, where they had dug around them and everything and just had them exposed on it. Yeah. And then when the Native American Graves Repatriation Act came into place, they took those and put them in boxes and put them on shelves too and just covered over the pit and extended the museum over it.
It just seems so bizarre that there wouldn't be... Can they track where the tribes are that these bodies belong to, or... Is there any, has anyone asked for these to be, given back so they could be, reburied?
These were the mound builders, which was you had your woodlands and, you had your mound builders and woodlands and all that. So these were the mound builders. So a lot of them are extinct tribes now.
Okay.
But the thing is, my thing was, if you had a mound park there and you had the mounds, why not just go ahead and, where the burial mound was, reconstruct that burial mound and just put them all in the burial mound and be done with it.
Sure. So my point to going back there was, has there been any stories that you're aware of in such a place of activity, that has all those bodies in it?
Well, I'll tell you one. Highway 65, and it runs through Alabama, down it crosses the Cahaba River. We were notified after it happened and it was too late and everything, but they had found some of the oldest boxed graves, native box graves and stuff like that, that was actually right there where they were building a bridge across the Cahaba River. And instead of notifying, they just bulldozed through and pushed a lot of it down into the river and off them bank and covered it up with, what they were building the grade to build the bridge and all of that.
Yeah.
So since then, there are all kinds, it's on a straightaway, and there's all kinds of wrecks. There's people that's gone off of the bridge. There's people that have collided in fireball wrecks and all kinds of things that's happened in that location. And, like I say, it's a clear straightaway.
Yeah.
And no reason for those kind of things to happen.
Sure. That kind of leads me to an interesting question, and one that I've kind of pondered for a while. All too often in Hollywood and in movies and such, the excuse for something being haunted is it was built on an Indian burial ground. It can be certainly overused at times. But my thought on when this legitimately does happen in situations like you just talked about with the roads, and then when somebody is pointing to this, going, look at all these accidents, horrible things happening really to innocent people. The people who are in those accidents, I'm sure, had nothing to do with let's plow and make this road and completely denigrate this site. Why is it that somewhat often, I would say, when we hear about the spirits being disturbed at an Indian burial ground, they become quite vengeful, but to the wrong people?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was to the wrong people. I mean, some of these things do happen, and all, like we were talking about that. But, the crews are gone and things like that, so they're just upset. But probably around 12, 14 years ago, I did a program with Dave Schroeder, if you know Dave.
Yeah.
And we did it on paranormal from a Native American perspective, and we got into this topic of the Hollywood Indian versus, what's really out there in the burial grounds and stuff.
Yeah.
And Hollywood always portrays it as, anybody goes through to start, just riding through, it's just so much vengeance and everything coming up, bad spirits and all that. I believe that there are spirits out there that are protectors, and they're left for a reason to protect something. Mm-hmm. And I believe if you go in a good way and do things good, then they never bother anybody or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're just going through and just leaving nothing but, you know, footprints. But those that go in and dig, desecrate, take things that are there that were left for the dead,
mm-hmm.
I think that's when they really get angry and things start happening.
Now, the perspective on that would be, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it's not necessarily the spirits of those who died or the people who were living that are buried there. It's the spirits that are there to protect those bodies that are there, to protect those remains that are more vengeful. Because I think sometimes we jump to, well, these were peaceful people. They, like, you or me, like, if I was dead, I wouldn't be going after somebody that had nothing to do with, you know, destroying my grave, you know, just because they then happened to be going along that path many years later without even knowing what happened. But I could see having vengeance towards the person who's making those decisions for destroying it. But it's not necessarily that. It's not the person that has remains there. It's the entity or the power that is that's watching it, which may never have been a human walking the earth. It's something there as a protector.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, protectors that are left there. I mean, you know, these spirit protectors to guard
mm-hmm.
and take care of, you know, just like a guardianship over that area and over the graves and over the things that are buried there.
That makes sense. I've never really thought of it from that perspective.
That's just like I was on Kindred Spirits with Amy Bruni and Adam Berry, and we did Hell's Barn Dam. The episode is called Blood in the Water.
Mm-hmm.
What had happened was Dragon Canoe had put a curse on the land when they were removed from the land. And when they built Hell's Barn Dam, TVA, it continued to flood for over 20 years. Their engineers could not figure out what was causing it. They could not stop it. It just got worse and worse and worse. And finally, they just imploded the dam part and left the turbine, you know, area and everything.
Sure.
And went somewhere else. Well, everything was fine and good for a while until one of the guys that was caretaking it at that time had upset him, and things started happening, started getting shoved, scratched, rocks thrown. When they filmed, Adam even had rocks thrown at him.
Mm-hmm.
So they reached out and contacted me because they had asked around through the Cherokee tribe and everything, and found out that I was into the paranormal and knew some of the old ways. And I actually went in and did an old Cherokee blessing ceremony to just appease them.
Mm-hmm.
And everything went back cool. Everything went back calm and peaceful after that. But, you know, it's like I say, it's the protectors and stuff there. And if you upset them, then that's when they just do what they're there for.
Sure. And it sounds like in that case, you were able to do something that did make a difference. That wraps up part one of our conversation. In part two, when you have a vengeful spirit that makes life difficult or impossible to move forward with, can that ever be reversed? Can peace be made? Does the offering one gives to make peace need to be a specific item? How did Ronnie begin investigating the dead in the Bible Belt nearly 40 years ago? Has Ronnie ever had any experiences that truly scared or terrified him? All those questions and more in part two of our conversation with Ronnie. To hear it, become a gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. Sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks or go to thegravetalks.com and click become a gravekeeper. You'll get access to all of our bonus episodes, all of our episodes in their entirety, all commercial free. Hundreds of interviews to start binging on right now. patreon.com/thegravetalks. Check it out and help keep our program on the air. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.